Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Okay, so Marcel Proust, In Search of Lost Time, it's huge, isn't it? We're talking 7 volumes, thousands of pages. This isn't just reading a book, it feels more like exploring a whole world.
Absolutely. À la recherche du temps perdu, it's this vast landscape, really. It captures a whole era, you know, the Belle Époque in France, right through the First World War. For you listening, it's more than just a story. It's a cornerstone of modernist literature.
And Proust himself, his life story kind of sets the stage perfectly. He was born in 1871, started out as this wealthy Parisian socialite, always observing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Watching the aristocracy he'd later write so much about.
Mm-hmm. But then his health issues, the asthma, forced him to withdraw more and more.
Exactly. Famously writing almost the whole thing propped up in bed in that cork-lined room. It's quite the image.
It really is. And it speaks to that inward turn. He's this key bridge figure, taking that detailed 19th century realism, the sharp eye for class, for social detail, and fusing it with this deep dive into psychology. The kind of thing that really shaped the 20th century novel. Think Joyce, think Wolfe.
So he was consciously trying to do something new with the novel form itself.
Oh, completely. His mission, you could say, was to challenge how novels worked. He made the act of remembering, the struggle with time and memory, the central drama. It's profoundly internal.
So where does this journey begin for the narrator? We meet him, people often call him Marcel, though he's unnamed middle-aged, right? And he's not in a good place.
Not at all. He's suffering from insomnia, yes, but also this really deep, gnawing sense of regret. Like his life's been wasted, that he hasn't achieved anything, especially artistically. He feels stuck.
Stuck. Okay. And something has to break that stasis.
And does. Through what's probably the most famous literary device ever, involuntary memory. This brings us straight to the scene, the Madeleine.
Ah, the Madeleine dipped in tea. Everyone knows that bit, even if they haven't read the book.
Right. He's given this simple cup of lime blossom tea, a little scallop cake, he tastes it, and boom, it's not just a memory, it's an explosion.
And it's crucial, isn't it, that this isn't him trying to remember, it just happens.
Exactly. That's the distinction Proust hammers home. Voluntary memory, when you sit and think, what happened then? That's intellectual, filtered. This involuntary memory, triggered by a taste, a smell, a sensation, it's overwhelming. It bypasses the intellect.
And it brings back his childhood village, Cumbrae.
The entire village. Suddenly the past isn't just remembered, it's relived. It feels more real, more vibrant than his current sort of faded existence.
Proust seems to be saying this kind of memory is pure, more authentic.
That's the idea. Voluntary memory gets distorted by everything that's happened since. Involuntary memory delivers the past as it was felt, bringing that past self right into the present. And this sets up the big question for you, the reader. Can this life, which feels shattered and lost to what he calls time the destroyer, actually be put back together? Can it find meaning through this process of retrieval, through art?
Okay, so that involuntary memory is the key, the engine.
Sure.
But how does he organize this flood of recovered time? Does Cumbrae, his childhood world, give it some structure?
It absolutely does. His childhood memories are structured around 2 walking paths the family used to take. These paths become huge symbols for the whole novel.
All right, I remember this. They're Swan's Way.
Swan's Way, yes.
Yeah.
That path leads towards the home of Charles Lyon, who's this wealthy, cultured bourgeois figure. It comes to represent art, complex relationships, and especially the torments of love and jealousy.
And the other path?
That's the Guermantes Way. It leads towards the lands of the local aristocracy, the ancient nobility. So this path symbolizes social ambition, status, history, that whole glittering world the narrator longs to enter.
So love and society, the 2 big preoccupations.
Exactly. The novel basically tracks his journey along both these ways.
Let's follow Swan's Way first. His story, Swan and Love, it's like a whole separate novella dropped into the first volume, isn't it? Why is his experience so foundational?
Swan is fascinating. He's sophisticated, an art connoisseur, has all this potential, but he throws it all away for his obsessive love for Odette de Crécy, who's essentially a courtesan.
And it's not a healthy love.
Far from it. Proust shows how Swan's passion turns him into this jealous detective. He's utterly consumed by trying to know everything about Odette, trying to possess her mind, her past. It's a deep dive into the pathology of jealousy.
It's brutally honest. And that famous line later when Swan realizes he wasted years of my life for a woman who wasn't even my type.
Ouch. Devastating clarity, isn't it? It's the blueprint for the narrator's own suffering later. Swan's failure basically teaches that this kind of romantic love isn't about true connection. It's often about projecting our own needs onto someone, trying to possess the unknowable other, which is, well, impossible.
Okay, so that's the cautionary tale of Swan's Way. Meanwhile, the narrator himself is obsessed with the other path, the Guermantes way. He wants to get into high society.
Oh, desperately. He idolizes the Duchesse de Guermantes, Oriane. She represents the absolute peak of Parisian aristocratic life. He dreams for years of being accepted into their circle, their salon.
He builds them up in his mind.
Enormously. But then he actually gets there. He penetrates the Guermantes circle and the illusion shatters.
Ah, the crucial disillusionment. He finds out they're just people.
Worse than that, often, beneath the sparkling wit and ancient titles, he finds pettiness, cruelty, snobbery, a kind of moral emptiness. The gods have clay feet.
So another dead end, in a way. Social climbing doesn't bring fulfillment either. This pushes him further inward, doesn't it? Towards his own major relationship with Albertine.
Yes. After the disillusionment with society, his focus shifts intensely to Albertine Simonet, whom he meets at the seaside resort of Belbec. This becomes his great love affair, but it's immediately plagued by the same kind of consuming jealousy that destroyed Swan. He suspects her of having affairs, particularly with other women.
And this relationship dominates the middle volumes, like The Captive. The title itself sounds suffocating.
It is. That volume depicts him literally keeping Albertine prisoner in his Paris apartment. He tries to control her every move, her thoughts, her friendships. It's this incredibly intense, claustrophobic depiction of possessive love. It shows how love, for Proust, can be a projection of the lover's own anxieties, not a real seeing of the other person.
It's painful to read. And then in The Fugitive, she escapes him.
She flees. And then, tragically, she dies in an accident shortly after.
You'd expect this to be the ultimate heartbreak.
And initially, the grief is immense. But what Proust explores next is maybe even more profound. The gradual process of forgetting. The narrator realizes his intense suffering starts to fade. Not just because time passes, but because the idea of Albertine, the construct built from his own jealousy and desires, begins to dissolve.
So time doesn't just heal, it kind of erases the very thing that caused the pain.
It erases the attachment to the self-created image. He realizes his love was more about his own internal drama than about the real Albertine. It's a hard truth.
While all this personal drama unfolds, Proust is also weaving in a broader critique of society, especially with characters like the Baron de Charlis.
Yes, Charlis is pivotal. In Sodom and Gomorrah, the narrator accidentally discovers Charlis's homosexuality, opening up this whole hidden world of what Proust calls sexual inversion. It becomes a major theme. The secrets, the codes, the hypocrisy, and the psychological toll of living a hidden life within that rigid aristocratic society.
Charlis is such a larger-than-life character. So proud, so aristocratic, but leading this double life. It ends tragically for him, doesn't it?
Utterly. His arc is one of slow, painful decline, culminating in public humiliation, especially during the war years depicted later. He goes from being this feared, witty arbiter of taste to, well, seeking degradation.
There's that shocking scene later on, isn't there?
Yeah.
During the war.
Yes. The scene in Jupien's male brothel disguised during wartime air raids, Charlis, the great nobleman, is found seeking pleasure in being chained and beaten. It's a brutal image of his inner torment and the complete collapse of his pride, mirroring, in a way, the decay of his entire class.
And the First World War itself looms large in the later volumes. It seems to accelerate that social decay.
Definitely. The war shakes everything up. Old social boundaries blur. The aristocracy loses its grip. Fortunes change. It creates this backdrop of chaos and loss, which sets the scene perfectly for the final volume, Time Regained.
So we come to the end of the search. The narrator is older now, back in Paris after years away. He goes to one last party.
A final Guermantes soiree. And it's initially a scene of horror.
Horror? Why?
Because he looks around the room and sees what time has done. His former acquaintances, the brilliant figures of his youth, are now these aged, almost grotesque caricatures of themselves. Time has ravaged them. He sees Time the Destroyer made visible, and it nearly crushes him with despair.
The ultimate memento mori. He feels like time has won.
It's his lowest point. But then, right on the heels of that despair, comes the final breakthrough epiphany. It happens through a series of simple physical sensations.
Like the Madeleine again.
Exactly like the Madeleine. He stumbles on an uneven paving stone in the courtyard, the clink of a spoon against a plate, the feel of a starched napkin. Each sensation unexpectedly resurrects a past moment, a past feeling, with that same overwhelming vividness.
But this time it's different.
It's different because now he understands it. He realizes these moments of involuntary memory are the keys. They prove that the past isn't truly lost. It exists within him, ready to be recovered.
And he sees that his life, all the suffering, the snobbery, the failed loves, the wasted time, it wasn't wasted after all.
Precisely. It was all necessary material. The pain, the joy, the observations, the disillusionments, that was the raw stuff his art needed. He realizes that art is the only way to truly conquer time, to take these fleeting, subjective moments of lived experience and transform them into something lasting, something universal.
To give shape and meaning to the chaos of life.
And in doing so, to unify the self, he'd felt like a succession of different selves over the years, fragmented by time. Now the act of artistic creation can bring them all together.
So the book ends with him resolving to write this very book.
Exactly. It's a perfect circle. He finds his vocation at last. He will write In Search of Lost Time. The search is over because he's found the means to preserve time itself.
Wow, that's incredibly powerful. It makes you look at your own past, your own memories, differently.
It really does. That's the lasting impact. It teaches you that wisdom isn't handed down. It's discovered through your own journey, a journey no one can take for us or spare us, as he says. It's about finding new eyes, not just new landscapes.
And that even a life that feels full of mistakes or suffering can be redeemed, can find meaning, if you can transform it through reflection, through art in the broadest sense.
I think if we leave you with one core idea, it's this. Proust shows us that while time might seem to destroy everything, art born from wrestling with that very destruction is maybe the only thing that truly endures.
Yeah, that feels right. The only real paradise maybe is the one we've lost, but then managed to recapture and reshape through memory and creation.
Beautifully put.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.